when we snorkeled in Norway with trains of humpbacks. And we snorkeled during the herring run. And the trains of humpbacks just keep coming. And if you're snorkeling, you can see four trains all above each other stacked. We saw hundreds of humpbacks. And you can hear them vocalizing underwater.
That's Susan Eaton. She's a polar explorer, geoscientist, educator, and the founder and leader of Sea Women Expeditions. In 2015, Canadian Geographic named Susan one of Canada's top 100 modern-day explorers. A year later, they also named her one of Canada's 25 greatest women explorers ever. She's also an RCGS fellow and my guest on this episode of Explore, the Canadian Geographic podcast. Welcome to all you explorers out there, armchair and in motion. It's April. Spring is here in the Gatineau Hills. The sun finally feels warm on the skin. It's hard to believe that just a week ago we got dumped on with a foot of snow carried by howling winds. I'll be honest, it was borderline depressing. Snow in April is abominable, said Anne Shirley of Anne of Green Gables fame. It's like getting a slap in the face when you were expecting a kiss. That could not be more true. Now I hear you. Snow in April is definitely a thing that happens in this part of the world. And when you've already had days of 15-degree weather, the return to winter is much harder to stomach. By the third day inside the snow globe, I did grudgingly admit it looked beautiful, especially the snow-kissed branches in the forest and their reflection on the parts of the lake where the ice had already retreated. Ironically, the winds from that snowstorm helped break up the lake ice. So shimmering open water replaced months of monochrome white, which is so welcome. And the fact that ducks and geese were patrolling those open waters was a reminder that spring was, in fact, actually here. Further evidence of that was that I spent my weekend on the front porch boiling down maple sap into maple syrup. I've been doing this for about 4 years now. It's a nice diversion from what passes for spring up here. I tap 11 sugar maples behind the house. It takes about 30 liters of sap to produce a liter of syrup, and it takes hours. I was up till 2 a.m. on Saturday night. The process is pretty zen-like. Really, not much happens, and you need to pay attention, adding sap to the boil regularly. If you don't, if you aren't mindful, the risk is having the whole thing boil over, and you're left with, at best, some sticky maple taffy in a big mess. Happily, that didn't happen this year, and I now have 10 liters of dark, sweet, and delicious syrup. Sitting on the porch as I manage the boil, sun shining, temps back in the teens, I got to watch the lake ice make its final retreat, bit by bit, until by the end of the day, there was open, shimmering water from our shore right across to the other side. It ends in a flicker. The ice that once locked up the lake hard for months turns to something that looks like a dull slushy, and then, with a puff of wind, it magically fades into the water. If you turn your head, you can miss it. And that's the change of seasons up here. It involves a full range of emotions, and blackfly season is still to come. Water is very much a topic of discussion today with Susan Eaton. For the past decade, her organization, Sea Women Expeditions, has been leading Indigenous and non-Indigenous women scientists, artists, educators, storytellers, and more on Arctic sea voyages of discovery. We'll get into what that means in this discussion. Our conversation includes swimming parts of the Northwest Passage, diving with orcas and whales, and what she's learned about the polar regions and the changes being brought there by climate change. It ends with a lovely ode to Haida Gwaii, so stick around for that. Let's get to it. Susan Eaton, welcome to the Explore podcast.
Thank you very much, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. And I, first of all, want to thank you because you were really one of the stars of the RCGS Polar Plunge this year, which supports this podcast in Canadian Geographic. And you are in Yellowknife and were out on Great Slave Lake with some sort of horrible flu, minus 38 degree weather. I mean, you're a hero. Well done. How was that on your end?
Well, it was a challenge because I was quite sick, but given that I pulled this team of Yellowknifers together to plunge into Great Slave Lake, I decided that I needed to be part of the team and not just a watcher from afar. So I participated, even though my physician about an hour before said she wasn't certain it was a good idea. It was great. It was great fun. The lake was warm in comparison to the air temperature of minus 38.
Yeah.
And we had a very controlled and safe place to plunge, which was wonderful. And at the end of the plunge was a sauna, which was quite welcome, actually. But I thought I was going to freeze before I got in the water. So it was welcome getting into the lake itself. You know, it's the deepest lake in North America and the 10th largest in the world. So it's a pretty epic place to plunge for Canadian Geographic and the Explorer.
Yeah,
podcast.
No, great visuals. Yeah, well, yeah. I know. It was so, I mean, it's just so great having North of 60 represented like that in that way. And I know you're a Yellowknifer yourself now, and that's really one of my favorite. It's my little one of my favorite cities. It so punches above its weight. It's a town, really. But man, it's so much fascinating things going on there all the time. What attracted you there?
Well, initially I moved here to work, but I'd always liked Yellowknife. I had lived in Southern Northwest Territories prior to that and always flew into Yellowknife to go somewhere else. And I'm intrigued by the lake. It's so large and quite spectacular. And I like the small community feel of this place. I mean, there's big box stores here, and yet it's a very small town. And I live in Old Town, which is the historic part of Yellowknife. So it's almost like you're living in a mining town from the 1930s or 40s, because it's still very small. Of course, there's some modern buildings, but not many. There's still a lot of the old wooden buildings that are circa 1930, 1940, and even older that are functioning restaurants and so on in Yellowknife. So I quite like the charm of the old and the new together. And of course, you know, there's many indigenous groups of people in and around Yellowknife. And so it's very diverse, and there's a lot of newcomers here. And it's amazing, the large Francophone community here. And many of the Francophones are from France and from West Africa. So it's extremely diverse and quite enjoyable to live here. With the exception, of course, when it goes down to minus 55, you know, during winter, which it did this year. A little bit disheartening when your battery turns into a slushy and you have to replace it. But other than that, it's great. And the summers are beautiful. It's getting light very quickly right now, and it's getting difficult to see the northern lights because the sky is still pretty light at 10 or 11 o'clock at night.
I mean, it's also a great art scene there, too. Great restaurants. And the constant, especially in the summer, that constant hum of the float planes all going off to fascinating places. You know, it's like there's a real, it's a romantic.
I have a bird's eye view of the float plane area, both in Back Bay and Houseboat Bay. And so I love watching them take off and land in the summer. And in the winter, they take off and land on skis. So the action still happens in the winter here, too. The Twin Otters are taking off and landing in an airstrip that's sort of marked by Christmas trees on the ice. It's pretty exciting to see them come in and also take off.
So I love when I'm talking to my explorers just to figure out where that sort of spark of adventure came from. And I know you're from Halifax originally, and obviously that's close to the ocean, and the ocean is very much the focus of a lot of the work you do. What was it that sort of led you in the direction you're working now?
Well, my mother is a marine biologist with Department of Fisheries and Oceans, and when I was in high school, I have three younger sisters. She took each one of us out of school to go on field trips with her. So we all three of us got to go in, all four of us got to go individually with her. I, in the end, was the only one of the four girls who became a scientist, but having a mother scientist, I think was pretty inspirational for all of us at a time when a lot of women didn't work outside the home. So I thought I wanted to be a marine biologist for the longest time, and my mother kept saying, no, don't do it. Even with a PhD, you won't get a job. And she kept saying, I wouldn't do it. But when you're 18, you don't believe your mother. So I went right into marine biology at Dalhousie and was overwhelmed by the number of students in marine biology. It was staggering. And I took geology my first year just as an elective because I had a rock and shell collection as a child. And I really loved the geology. So I ended up doing a double major in marine biology and geology. And you know, it served me well because in the end, I worked as a scientist for most of my career, but now I'm leading ocean expeditions to the Arctic. So, you know, the very early, I'd say the very early education that I had as a marine biologist and the inspiration of my mother has taken me full circle to where I am today. So it started with my mother and then continued through my studies and my interest in the Arctic as well. It's led me to where we are today.
Where did your mom take you? Where was that field expedition?
Oh, boy. We actually did many things. We were flying in planes off the east coast of Nova Scotia, spotting whales. If a whale washed ashore, my mother would do the necroscopy. She would dissect it. even sea turtles, any big animal that washed ashore, she would go to dissect it and try to understand what was going on. Fishery patrol vessels, my mother would occasionally board those and see if there was illegal catches aboard. Keep in mind, my mother was about 85 pounds and not too tall, and this little woman telling foreign fishing boats that they had to, you know, they're going to be fined. It's just not a good look. You know, they were really quite terrified of her. But so, yes, another day I was on a trip with her. I had to call search and rescue because she was stuck on an island offshore Halifax in the fog and had to be rescued from a place called Ikum Sikum. And they'd gone out to actually harvest some seals for some of the work she was doing. And then we heard there were no more rifle shots and the fog came in. And my mother was there for about 6 hours. And I said to her summer student, who was a university student, I was 17 at the time, I think we need to call search and rescue because there's no way they're getting off the island today. Yeah. But my mom was a fatty acid lipid expert. And the reason they were looking at some of the organs of the seals and the whales was that she's trying to develop a synthetic alternative to whale oil during her career. So that's her specialty, actually. Marine mammals and oils, lipids, fatty acids, lipids,
That's amazing. What a gift that she took you along and all those things too, you know?
And my other sisters, who, as I said, didn't become scientists, but they equally benefited from, you know, catching salmon in the Bay of Fundy to, they were doing all kinds of things. So it truly was a lot of fun and very interesting. For example, we go fishing in Prince Edward Island, where my mother's from, and she would, you know, fillet the fish right away. And not only would she do that, she'd cut the heart out and hold it in her hand. And we'd all be watching it beat, which was quite alarming for children. But that was the biology lesson.
Yeah. You
know, the heart will continue to beat for some time after the animal's been cut up. Wow. So, yeah, that was my mother.
That's amazing. And so you've spent a lot of time in the water, under the water. Was that part of your childhood growing up, snorkeling, scuba? When did that come in?
Well, true. My father was a scuba diver, early adopter of scuba, probably in the 1950s in Nova Scotia. Mm. And he used to dive on wrecks and harvest or salvage, the right word, salvage, brass fittings and so on, and sell them for extra money as a young man. So my father was a diver. My mom was a marine biologist. And because I wanted to become a marine biologist, I thought at age 16, the only way Jacques Cousteau would hire me was if I was a scuba diver. So hence, I took my diving certification at age 16. And our checkout dives were in February in Halifax Harbor. And it was a blizzard that weekend. And it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And it's a wonder that I ever actually dived again after that weekend of checkout dives. But I was hooked. And diving has taken me all over the world. And definitely a very different way to explore the oceans from underneath. You know, most people look at the ocean, but they don't know what's underwater. And when you dive or snorkel, you have a window into another world.
Yeah, and you've dove and snorkeled in so many different amazing places. The one that struck me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that you swam the Northwest Passage. Am I right in saying that?
Well, we didn't exactly swim the Northwest Passage. Our first expedition, a seaman expedition to Nunatsiavut, which is northern Labrador, and Greenland, was supposed to include Baffin Island as well, but due to ice conditions, we didn't get there. We were testing the concept of snorkeling the Northwest Passage using diver propulsion vehicles. And in fact, we've got a number of firsts in terms of, you know, a 70-kilometer transect with DPVs, diver propulsion vehicles, or scooters, and a team of women doing a snorkel relay. And what's really interesting about the whole concept, I initially thought, well, let's snorkel the Northwest Passage as a metaphor for climate change, because if we can snorkel it, it means that, you know, there's less ice, the ice is thinner, and so on. And let's do that. And along the way, visit Inuit communities and work on our education and knowledge-based program, which is Ocean Education Knowledge Sharing Program. But as the expeditions evolved and more women were involved and more Inuit were involved, and I'm the expedition leader and I'm listening, and Inuit especially said, well, why would you want to snorkel the Northwest Passage? At, you know, why would you do that? It seems like a lot of money, because it was probably a $5 million price tag. Right. And a lot of carbon and a huge undertaking, and it would have taken us likely 100 days. And not everyone has 100 days to do something that epic. So, you know, the expedition evolved from I'm going to snorkel the Northwest Passage, lead a team. We're going to conquer the Northwest Passage. We're going to do it for climate change. We're going to, engage with Indigenous communities along the way, include Indigenous women and girls in our team, to what is the most important, perhaps, and sort of important way to spend our time and money and effort. Is it doing something that might be deemed to be a stunt, or is it spending more time in community? And based on the feedback I got from my team members and feedback I got from Inuit elders and Inuit participants, it seemed that community was more important, and I agree, in terms of engaging as opposed to the act of doing. And quite frankly, the word conquer the Northwest Passage is a very old-fashioned term for exploration. It's very patriarchal. The patriarchy, we're going to conquer the Northwest Passage, we're going to put the flag on the South Pole or the North Pole, and it's a very old-fashioned way of exploring. And I think women tend to explore the planet differently. They seek to understand, they seek to engage, and we seek to understand a place through the eyes of the people who live there. Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about climate change in the North, in the circumpolar region, it's the Inuit, it's the Inupiaq, it's the Sami, and it's the other Indigenous peoples of the North. So I pivoted because I thought, okay, you know, really what's important is the engagement component, the learning component, and the snorkel of the Northwest Passage. Well, maybe that's not so important because we'll get to those communities anyhow, but we'll be able to be more impactful. Mm-hmm. And develop long-term relationships with those communities if we keep coming back. And that, I think, is important to keep coming back. And so we've been to Nunavut several times. We've been to Greenland twice. And we intend to return to Nunavut and to Greenland to continue the work that we started in 2014. So, yeah, we were going to originally snorkel the Northwest Passage for climate change, and we proved that we could do it. We ran 70 kilometers in less than 10 hours using the DPVs and 9,000 feet of water between Baffin Island and Greenland. We ran up the coast of Greenland equally fast. And it's doable. But at the end of the day, the carbon, the time, and perhaps the stunt, if you will, didn't seem to make as much sense as getting to know the people and providing opportunities for a lot of these young women in these communities to participate in our expeditions in a different way. So... Mm-hmm. That is how sort of gone from the sort of old-fashioned view of exploration, the patriarchal fashion, the colonial fashion, if you will, envisioning exploration to much more, okay, we're a group of women, we're exploring the planet differently, and what's important to us? And more importantly, what's important to the people who we're going to encounter along the way? And so that's why we pivoted, and we have been everywhere, actually. We've been all over the circumpolar reaches, and we continue to go. And we always include Indigenous women of the areas we're traveling, not as team members only, but as leaders. Yeah. They're setting the tone. We take our lead from them. And so it's been really quite gratifying working in the North with people of the North and having them help fashion the expeditions as well.
What communities, I mean, you return there, and what communities have sort of hold a special place in your heart?
We really like Nain, and that was one of the first communities we went to in 2014. We spent 2 or 3 days on the pier, the government pier in Nain, with our big saltwater aquariums, which were populated temporarily with sea critters from the ocean. Then they became touch tanks, and the kids were able to reach in and pull out a starfish or another invertebrate. They were seeing fish free swimming for the first time. Now, they do fish these fish from ice or boats, but they never see them swimming. We also had robots. We were building robots on the pier, and the kids were flying them in the ocean. So Nain was a beautiful place, a very welcoming community.
Where is that?
It is on the north. Well, northeast coast of Labrador, on the Labrador Sea, and it is in the territory called Nunatsiavut, which is the Inuit territory portion of Labrador. And you fly there from Goose Bay by small aircraft. And the airstrip is very short, right beside the ocean. And you're coming in, you're thinking, I hope that this plane is going to land on this airstrip because it looks pretty short. from Maine, we picked up a vessel, and then we sailed up the coast to Torngat, where we're scuba diving offshore Torngat Mountains.
Yeah.
Absolutely stunning. And up towards Baffin Island, towards Iqaluit and Pengnirtung, but there was too much ice for us to land at Pengnirtung, so we went right across the Davis Strait. We spent time in Pont Inlet, which is another beautiful community where they don't have a pier. So when we set up our robot building workshop for the kids, we laid out big tarps on the sand, all the bits and pieces. The kids sat on the tarps, built the robots, went into the water and flew them in the water. And our robots have video cameras in them so the kids can see what is underwater. So
these are like underwater drones, basically, are they?
Is that,
Yeah.
We call it bringing the ocean to eye level for Inuit youth. And that is, you know, doing it either with the drones that are equipped with video cameras, or the touch tanks, or snorkeling or scuba diving as well. We've had young women, girls, and elders snorkeling with us in Packice and Frobisher Bay, and young Inuit women who got certified to become scuba divers, who actually got to dive in Dundas Harbor on Devon Island during one of the expeditions we were on, which was pretty exciting for them to dive in their own territory, their first dives in the ocean. So it's all
tell
about
us what,
introducing...
Tell us what you see when you're under water in the Arctic Ocean, because I think it's surprising. I think it might surprise
see,
people, right?
Yeah, a lot of invertebrate life. So a lot of shellfish, a lot of slugs or snails, seaweed, a lot of seaweed. And in fact, Inuit do harvest seaweed occasionally and dry it, just like other groups of people eat seaweed. Not always a lot of fish. We were looking for Greenland sharks in 2016 in Frobisher Bay, and we had a bait ball in Frobisher Bay of rancid, made up of rancid walrus and narwhal that one of the hunters gave us. And we were diving on the bait ball to see if it was being nibbled on, because we had satellite tracking tanks to put on the Greenland sharks, but no bites. And so we were hoping to attract Greenland sharks on that expedition, because they're one of the longest lived animals in the ocean, and they're a great animal to study climate change. If you can track them, see where they're going and so on. What else did we see? We saw something that surprised us the first time. It was that the ice scour is so deep along the coast that oftentimes you don't see a lot of marine life till you get to about 20 to 25 feet out. Because every winter, the ice comes in along the coast, it pushes in, and it scours. And so what you'd see in the intertidal in British Columbia or Nova Scotia, you need to go out almost to about 20 feet to see it below the ice scour. So that was very, very interesting, which meant that our dive profiles had to change in terms of depth. Our divers were trained as scientific divers to be able to collect, safely collect, the marine life to put in the aquariums and then repatriate them back to their homes. We took them back. But so that was very interesting. I think that we were also surprised at the lack of water clarity if you're close to a glacier. We were on an expedition ship at one point. We were an expedition within an expedition, 18 of us, and the ship would, you know, want to stop near a glacial tongue or a sort of tidewater glacier. Groups of zodiacs would go to the glacier. We go a slightly different direction to go snorkeling or scuba diving. But the rock flour that's dissolved in the ocean from the glacier made it impossible to see your hand. So if you're doing underwater photography, you can't see your camera even unless you've got it really, really close to your face. We were shocked by how much rock flour was in the bays where we were diving close to glaciers, which means that, of course, it's not a good fit. Divers and people who are doing topside photography and exploration, we needed to be further away from the ice in order to be able to see. In Greenland, off the southwest coast of Greenland, we saw a lot of marine life. We saw a lot of fish, including salmon, including cod, Greenland cod. And from my perspective as a geologist, a lot of amazing rocks. And geologists above, you know, when they're walking on the land, they always carry a water bottle. They squirt rocks so they can see what the rocks look like wet. Well, when they're in the ocean, they're just amazing. And so the rocks in Greenland in particular, full of garnets, just spectacular rocks. And so I was always conflicted. Would I take photographs of the critters or would I take photographs of the rocks? And generally speaking, the rocks won because there was a whole team of people taking photographs of the animals and the seaweed and so on. So a lot of interesting things. We saw a few seals underwater, not many, but a few. They're usually timid.
Yeah.
And we didn't see any whales underwater, except, of course, when we snorkeled in Norway with pods of orcas and also trains of humpbacks. And wow. A train of humpbacks is a whole convoy of humpbacks. And we snorkeled during the herring run in 2019 and 2022. And the trains of humpbacks just keep coming. And if you're snorkeling, you can see four trains all above each other stacked. And you can see them because their pectoral fins are white on top. So you can count the number of whales below you by seeing their white pectoral fins, the big ones that stick out to the side. And we saw hundreds of humpbacks.
So how close are you to them? Like what's that experience?
Very
like?
Close. And you can hear them. You can hear them talking underwater. You can hear them vocalizing underwater. Yeah. And equally so the orcas too. And they have a different way of speaking to each other, but the orcas are working together in pods to do carousel sort of hunting, which they called it carousel feeding. And they basically swim around the herring and create a ball. And they swim in a circle like in a carousel, and they're herding the herring into a big bait ball, if you will. And then, of course, they come in and one at a time they feed because orcas have teeth and they can't open their mouths and just gulp in the herring like humpback would. So they slap the bait ball with their tails, they stun the fish and they pick one out at a time and they eat it. Whereas the bait ball's ready, the orcas have put the bait ball together and the humpbacks just swim right over the top of the bait ball with their mouths open and just grab it and keep going.
Yeah.
So, you know, the orcas do all the work and the humpbacks take advantage of that. So they actually feed in a very synergistic way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's fascinating. Yeah.
Amazing.
We saw
incredible. Are they taking much interest in you or are you just sort of something on the side there?
Well, that's a very good question because we have a master's degree thesis coming out of our 2022 expedition. And that is an ethogram study of do snorkelers impact free swimming orcas? And, you know, what are the orcas' responses to snorkelers?
Mm.
Are they good? Are they bad? Are they aggressive? Are they passive? And we've identified 8 to 9 different body language, if you will, ethogram is body language, responses to snorkelers. And that thesis work is undergoing and probably will be published in I'd say 18 months. But the babies are very curious. The juvenile orcas are very curious, and they do look at you. And sometimes they'll swim by and look at you. And then a whale needs to turn its body to look at you because their eyes are fixed on the side of their heads. So they need to shift their body to get a look at you.
What's that like looking a whale in the eye though? Like,
it's humbling. It's humbling, and knowing that it's a privilege to be able to do that, and knowing that it's not just an adventure. It's we're there for a reason. We're also doing a water sampling for environmental DNA analysis as well. So we're there to actually understand the ecosystem that we're exploring. And there's a responsibility, in my opinion, as an explorer, to inform and educate people about what you've learned. And not just to be a voyeur, if you will, or an adventurer, but actually to understand the place and to further the understanding of the place. So whether it's engaging with indigenous people in the communities you're working in, or if you're studying whales, to make sure that that what we're doing is relevant. And in 2019, we actually did environmental DNA water sampling with the University of Tromsø in northern Norway as well. So we always engage with academic institutions to make sure that we're collecting data for studies that they're undertaking, or we're initiating our own studies and finding partners and so on. So we're excited that the first thesis is coming out of one of our expeditions.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
It is important because what we learn will hopefully be able to inform the Norwegian government on how to manage ecotourism with orcas.
Right. Yeah.
Because there is not a lot of regulation, and we want to ensure that the orcas are able to feed unhindered, because they're there to feed on this huge biomass, which is the herring. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of whale watching boats. There's a lot of zodiacs that are putting snorkelers in. So there's a lot of, in my opinion, stressors on them because mm-hmm. of the ecotourism industry. So we're there to be part of the solution as opposed to just to be voyeurs and say, I got that picture of the orca type of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So clearly coming out of that thesis is going to be they do need some space, right? Is that the...
They do need space. Yeah, absolutely. And, maybe the boats need to be limited. There has to be a reduction in the number of boats that are actually viewing them from topside or as from our perspective in snorkeling as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've heard stuff too, just about the noise of motorboats and big or even bigger ships too. And
absolutely. It's a noisy world for whales. And if you need echolocation to find your food, to find your mate, to migrate across the North Atlantic, it's a noisy world. Electric motors or electric engines would be far better for many reasons. But at the same time, slowing down the speed at which a boat is propelled through the water increases or diminishes the noise and the type of engine. You know, some propellers can be internalized, some are outside or external props, and there's many things to do. And I think that a humpback song could be carried all the way from Nova Scotia to France. It's a low ground roll frequency, and it crosses the entire Atlantic. And scientists postulate, you know, are they looking for a mate? Are they announcing that the migration is starting? Are they talking about threats? You know, what are they doing? But the sounds travel across the ocean. Most whales stop chatting when boats go by.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
it can't be heard, right? We would too. A plane flies overhead, we stop speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And the orcas and other whales in the ocean stop talking when a boat goes by. So it's the same concept.
Yeah, yeah, it's something. I remember hearing just during the pandemic, early on in the pandemic, when a lot of things stopped, including even boat traffic, that, you know, just how things shifted underwater, like things became more active. And
I think people heard the orcas again. And on the northern tip of Vancouver Island and in Port McNeil, Port Hardy area, the transients come in there, and it's very noisy because there's cruise ships coming into the northern tip of Vancouver Island. There's lots of fishing boats. And during the pandemic, there's an eco lab up there, and they were listening to orcas, and they had an unparalleled opportunity to hear orcas for 2 years without that shipping traffic.
Amazing.
And so that was a really great opportunity to advance their research without the chatter and the big noise of boats. So yeah, it's absolutely a significant issue for whales, not only whales, but other marine mammals too.
So with Sea Women expeditions, you've been going a decade now, right? At least?
Yes.
Yeah, which is amazing. And obviously a lot of that work is in the Arctic. And with climate change, I mean, what have you seen yourself in that last decade? What changes have you seen?
Well, people ask me that, and I think that a decade may not be long enough to be able to comment on that, because we know that climate change is something that happens over multi-decades. But I prior to going, spending a lot of time in the Arctic, I was in Antarctica on climate-based expeditions as a geophysicist and geologist, and traveling with scientists who had spent 50 years in Antarctica, and listened to what they had to say about Antarctica and how they had seen significant changes in ice coverage, you know, whether it's ice shelves or glaciers disappearing in Antarctica. And so I think their career, the 50 years of their career in one place, is so important to capture. And so when people ask me, have I seen big changes year to year to year? The answer is yes, I've seen glaciers receding in Greenland as well, but I don't have the context of 30 to 50 years of research. Mm-hmm. As a right. research scientist, Antarctica is a really fascinating place to study because there are no indigenous people there. There are no inhabitants. And so it's really a big science lab. After spending, going to Antarctica on three climate change expeditions and visiting the Canadian Arctic and seeing how rapidly that was changing, I pivoted as well. And I decided, well, I only have so much time and money and energy that I want to focus my efforts on the Canadian Arctic, where there are real people being impacted by climate change in real time. And so sort of left Antarctica to get behind and focused on the Canadian Arctic. And I guess the people to ask that question to are the people who live there, who are there every year, and multi-generations, millennia of data in terms of oral history and so on. And they're telling us in a significant way that it's changing. So I defer to their judgments and their stories. And yes, I can see changes. And if you go back to the same place year after year and take photographs, you could see the glacial retreat.
Yeah,
there's no doubt. But on the big picture, and also if you're a fisherman, you know, as we know, the fish are moving north to get to colder water. The polar bears, the seals are moving north. The polar bears are following the seals. So if you're a hunter or a fisherman in the north, you can tell the climate is changing because the makeup of the fish that you're catching is changing. Maybe there's not as many fish. Maybe there's more. Maybe suddenly you've got a new species that you didn't have 40 years ago because it's marching north to get to colder water. So, yes, I do believe it's changing. And as they say, you know, at least 3 to 4 times faster than the rest of the planet. That's the Canadian Arctic, as is Antarctica. And what many people don't understand is that the oceans are really the drivers of climate change.
Yeah.
The oceans, because they make up 71% of the planet's surface area, the oceans, as they warm, are creating the climate change on the planet. And what we're seeing on the continents is based on what's going on adjacent to the continents in the oceans.
Yeah.
You know, the increased, the warming and acidification of the oceans is causing, you know, larger number of hurricanes, more intense hurricanes, cyclones, etc. And the Arctic vortex being pushed down onto the North American continent.
Mm-hmm.
And in circumpolar regions all the way down is causing very cold, snowy winters in North America. And people think, well, that's the exact opposite. If climate change is happening, why is our winters getting colder? But the warming ocean and the lack of multi-year sea ice, you know, that's causing climate change everywhere, and it's wreaking havoc with countries' infrastructure and transportation and so on. So I think we're seeing it. We're seeing it in the prairies. We're seeing it everywhere, that climate change, the Arctic Ocean warming is changing the climate of the continent of North America and the Pacific warming and the Atlantic warming. So, you know, it is
damage to marine life too, isn't it? The acidification you're talking about, for instance. I mean, there's now dead zones in certain parts of oceans. I know off like Washington State, right?
Well, if you're plankton that needs to secrete a calcium carbonate shell, then you can't do it if the ocean is too acidic. And there's oyster farms on the west coast of Washington State where the oysters can't secrete their shells because the water is too acidic.
Mm.
So if you're doing aquaculture, even growing oysters, and they can't secrete their shells or the shells are thinner, you know, you're going to have a different type of oyster ultimately. So it impacts everything from plankton all the way up through to the bigger animals in the ocean.
Is that farm runoff, a lot of that? Or what would be the cause from that, like fertilizers?
Well, the acidification, actually the acidification globally is because the carbon dioxide is being absorbed by the ocean and it turns into carbonic acid. So the acidification is coming through carbon dioxide being absorbed by the ocean. And for a very long time, that the absorption of CO2 was not in the climate change models.
Yeah.
But it is now. And people say, where did this carbon dioxide go? Like, until maybe the last decade, people weren't accounting for the fact that the ocean absorbs carbon dioxide in a very, very large way.
Yeah.
But yes, farm runoff, you know, that could be pesticides, fertilizers, and so on. And that would actually cause a nutrient bloom as well.
Yeah.
And up here in Great Slave Lake, we're seeing climate change impacting the lake. It's warming dramatically. And we're also having cyanobacteria or blue-green algae outbreaks on the lake. Wow. Both in the shallow waters along the lake shore and out in the deeper water. So cyanobacteria is a blue-green algae, and it's pretty toxic to the small animals that live in the lake, and then obviously to fish too. And so we're seeing it in the lakes in the subarctic here and the Arctic as well. It's not just the ocean that's changing, the lakes are changing too.
And quickly.
Very quickly, yes.
Yeah, which makes it hard for adaptation of species and all that kind of stuff, doesn't it?
Yes. Can species adapt as quickly as climate is changing? And that's a big question. And I was reading an article recently saying that the only way they could adapt is if they're genetically very diverse, because if there's a lot of genetic diversity within a population of an animal or species, they might have a chance to adapt. But if they are, an isolated population that may be genetically inbred, they might not have enough gene traits that would enable adaptation. So that's an issue. You know, if we have robust populations, they might survive. And we do know through time, and as a geologist, I think of time in very large blocks, in tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions of years.
Yeah.
We know that animals have always adapted. And we know that they will continue to adapt. But, you know, in our lifetime, in our children's lifetime, it's pretty dire right now, I'd say. But I'm hopeful. And so I don't think we do what we do if we're not hopeful. I think we continue forward, and education and awareness building is extremely important to me. So that's a very large part of what we do.
Yeah, I mean, what brings you hope?
I think people. People bring me hope. And I think that there's so many people, remarkable people, doing remarkable things on the planet. And, you know, from the community level to even champions in government, academics, and so on, everyone has a part to play. Communicators have a part to play. Journalists have a part to play. And parents especially have a part to play in terms of educating their children about what's going on and empowering them to make changes too. Because I think change can come at the youth level. We've seen it. Huge groundswells of young people who are saying, no, we don't want to give up. You know, we want to live our lives, and we want, you know, the whales to still be there. We want the forest to be there. So I think we need to engage with children in a very big way. And we do that a lot. We talk to kids a lot. And it's important because I think that when I speak to a class of grade 3 students, I think one of these kids could be an astronaut going to Mars in 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's where they may be headed. Definitely to the moon, but any one of these grade 3 children today could be the next prime minister or an astronaut or an oceanographer, or a writer or an artist, which is why we include the arts along with the sciences in our expeditions, because it's extremely important to engage at all levels in the discussion of ocean change and climate change and gender issues and how they are impacted by climate change as well. So that the reason that we're all women or non-binary, two-spirit and gender diverse people in our team is that women and all of this sort of diaspora, we're not always at the table. And so that's why Sea Women was created, to give women an opportunity to participate in polar expeditions, science at the poles, and to get the experience that they need to be at the table, to be part of the policy making, decision making, and you know, to be the scientists who are called on to inform public policy or decision making. So it's important, and also Indigenous women at the table as well. So you know, we're a big tent, if you will, with a lot of different people in that tent, but that. The group that we represent is not always equitably represented today in these big academic institutions, government, and other organizations. So we're trying to equip this group of people with the skills that will get them to where we they want to go and where we'd like to see them go to.
So, and researchers can reach out to you to if they want to take part in these expeditions. How does that work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And generally speaking, when someone reaches out to me about an expedition, I always say, well, okay, so what do you want to do? It's not, so the expeditions are created, the content is created by the team members. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because if everyone, and we're all volunteer or we're organized as volunteers, if you want to participate, what do you bring to the table? Maybe it's just enthusiasm because you haven't done something like this before, and that's absolutely mm-hmm. fine. But if you're a scientist, do you have a special program that you'd like to run, a research program? If you're an educator, what does that look like? We had a Cirque du Soleil acrobat in our team in 2022.
Nice.
who's in her mid-30s doing her science degree, and she's working at a space agency in the United States teaching acrobats about movement, astronauts about movement. So our teams are extremely diverse, educators, geographers, historians, engineers, scientists. But I'd say our scientists and engineers make up 40% of our team, and the rest are people from very, very different walks of life, including sculptors and artists, painters, playwrights, poets. So, you know, it's really important to talk about these subjects on all these media, across these media. And I also, the word STEM is something that people talk about a lot. Science, engineering, science, STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. But I like the acronym STEAM. The A stands for the arts, and that way no child is left behind, mm-hmm. or no adult, because you hear so many adults say, oh, I wasn't good at math or science either. You know, I never went on to do this because I wasn't good at math or science. Children say that all the time. Their parents say it. Their grandparents say it. But you don't have to be good at math or science to be part of an expedition to the Arctic, because you could be the writer. You could be the painter. You could be the documentarian. Underwater photographer. So STEAM is really the way to go in my mind to be inclusive. Yeah. And every child who participates in one of our expeditions, you know, with respect to our outreach program, knowledge sharing program, you know, they can participate at any level. And it's not just science and technology. And the same thing with the adults, by the way. And generally speaking, our expeditions, the artists are doing the science and the scientists are doing the art. Because they're both good at, everyone is good at both, and people want to learn a new skill set. So we actually have a big montage coming out from our 2022 mm-hmm. expedition where every person on the team created part of the pie, if you will. And mm-hmm. it's the impressions of the participants of the expedition to Arctic Norway, which will be coming out in what we call a mandala, a circular piece of art where all the pies were actually drawn by the team members. And our team was very, it was 34 women in 2022 and very, very always in continuous motion talking. But when we did our artwork for 2 hours, it was silence. Yeah. It was absolute silence and everyone was focusing on their vignette of what the exhibition looked like. And it was really quite remarkable how art captivated the scientists and all the other people. And so I really, and a lot of people don't color anymore. Adults certainly don't color, right? We all have it in us, and so many children and so many of the women in our team have said, I was told at a very young age that I wasn't good at art.
Mm-hmm.
Which would stifle anyone's creative energy if a teacher told you in grade 3 that you weren't good at art. And today these women are spectacular at art. And they were never bad at art, likely. But so it just goes to show how potentially an educator who is not overly positive can influence a child negatively. But conversely, an educator that inspires kids can send them to Mars or to the moon or to, you know, the bottom of the Mariana Trench in a submersible. So that's why I think that reaching children is extremely important. Some people think that children aren't the decision makers of today, and so that we should deal with, you know, their parents and their grandparents. But I say, well, they influence their parents and their grandparents. Mm-hmm. So we have to continue reaching out to children and youth and engage with them and as much as we can include them in in the knowledge sharing program that we do, so that you know, that's part of our legacy, is to work with youth, mm-hmm. children, girls, and boys, because it's great for boys to see women role models too, you know.
Yeah.
And it's great for boys to see a female astronaut in the classroom, or a female scuba diver or explorer. And so we need to break those stereotypes, I think.
Yeah.
Or female geologist, because most people think of geologists as men.
Definitely.
And there are a lot of women geologists out there, I can tell you. Yeah.
That's great. Well, they sound like, I mean, wonderful experiences. And so is there one in the works now coming up?
Yes, we're looking at returning to Greenland and to Nunavut. And we just need to find the right vehicle, if you will. For us, vehicle is a vessel. And there's not many vessels that ply Arctic waters. And the quandary for us is always cost, because if we want to go as a small team of people with our own vessel, it's very expensive. We could go on a bigger expedition ship that's got a set path and do our own thing. But then, as described earlier, you know, we end up snorkeling beside glaciers and we can't see anything. There's nothing to see with all the rock flour in the ocean water. But so we're looking for the right vessel to take us where we want to go. And having your own vessel gives you great independence. The boat has to be back on a certain day in the port, but in between, you could do whatever you want to do. And if you see something really exciting, whoa, you can stop and investigate, or you can go to a different community. So we're looking into vessels, and I think that it's a big job to put on these expeditions, because all of us work full time. So it's a labor of love, and it's all consuming. And, you know, we can't do it without support from a really broad community of advocates and champions for our team, and corporate partners and sponsors and friends and family who support team members to participate, and so on. So it takes a village to get one of these expeditions off the ground.
Right.
And just like Ernest Shackleton, I feel like Ernest Shackleton sometimes, you know, he was always raising money. And the boat for the Imperial Transarctic Antarctic Expedition, it left London. They didn't have enough money. And so he stayed behind to fundraise. And then he went to South America to fundraise. And I think he joined the boat in either Paraguay or Argentina. But, you know, on the reason they went to Grytviken to get all their supplies before going to Antarctica is that there was no telex between Grytviken and London, because he was over down on his bank account. He had no money. And the Norwegians thought, well, he's Sir Ernest Shackleton. You know, he's good for it. So he put everything on credit there. But if he'd gone to the Falklands, well, they would have known he had no money in his bank account to purchase anything. So I feel
fantastic.
Like I'm always trying to raise money. And then Roald Amundsen, when he left port to do his crossing of the Northwest Passage,
mm-hmm.
they had unpaid bills too.
Yeah.
And they had a meeting and they had a discussion. If we don't go now, we're going to miss the window to do the Northwest Passage crossing. What do? We leave. We just leave in the middle of the night with unpaid bills, and we go. And so I understand those two men in terms of how difficult it is to finance a vessel-based expedition.
Yeah.
And
right.
so many moving parts. And, you know, so I do feel like I'm always, you're a promoter, you're trying to raise money for the expedition, trying to find partners to bring either skills or services or people to the expedition who may be paid by, you know, their institutions. And then we're always fundraising for junior members of the team who socioeconomically are not as well set up as mm-hmm. the older team members. And so we want youth on the team, but we've got to support them too. So it's always a challenge. So I do empathize and identify with Shackleton and Amundsen at times, because it's monumental to put these things together, and money is always an issue.
Anyone out there listening who has an icebreaker that they want a loan to Susan and the crew? Yeah,
or we just jump on for 3 weeks. You know, we don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We come on with our science team and our experiments, and we go. But, you know, it still hasn't changed. And that's why polar exploration is not for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
Mounting one of these expeditions is a big task. And given that we're all volunteers. It's a lot of work for everyone in the team, and and you know, multi-team leaders in each one of the disciplines. Someone's running the women's leadership program. Someone's running the science program. Someone's running the art program. Other people are running the community outreach programs, and we've got a huge team put together because. And the good news is that the expeditions mate is created by the team members and executed by them. And because I could not do it all, and I might not hit the mark in terms of what everyone wants to do anyhow or what people expect. So if each individual on the team has a mission and she has to execute, then, you know, it's a collective as opposed to the expedition leader saying we're going to do this, this, and this. So I'm always looking for team members to bring ideas and horsepower to the team and to perform, you know, to put it together and then execute in the field. And, you know, failure is okay, too, because we learn from our I don't know, you know, we can fail. And I think that most people say that, well, you know, you learn from your mistakes. And I think it's true. The stakes aren't uber elevated. We're not on a mission to Mars or whatever, but you know, it's not about, it's a safe place for people if you know, things don't work out. And oftentimes the weather is the contributing factor. We've actually ended up in different places on three expeditions than we thought we would because of the sea ice. Yeah. So we always have plan B, C, and D, and it's usually plan C or D that works. Because it's just we just never know with ice what's going to happen. So, yeah, it's been interesting, and I've met so many fascinating people along the way, and so we've had some great champions and allies. It's been a real learning experience. People ask me what I do in my vacation. I say, well, I lead expeditions to the Arctic, you know, and they're big. And I say I lead. I always have a co-leader with me, and so we have co-leaders that are coming through the ranks as well, and young women that are doing science and going on to do PhDs, or they're in PhD programs already. So we have a team of leaders. And so, yes, I'm the expedition leader, but there's a huge group of women who are equally talented and pulling it all together and very excited about what we're doing. It's been a journey.
So I don't want to keep you too long, but I do want to ask, I ask everyone who comes on if they can name a favorite place in Canada.
Haida Gwaii. I love Haida Gwaii. Haida Gwaii, I've been there probably 5 times in the last 20 years. And I love the Pacific Northwest coast of Canada. And I've been all up and down the coastline, you know, from the Sunshine Coast up to the Kitsimatin to see grizzly bears. I've been to Princess Royal to see spirit bears. And that when I was... seeing spirit bears and grizzly bears, that was part of a rainforest conservation work I was doing as a volunteer working on protecting the old growth rainforest of British Columbia. I was able to go to the Kitsimatin and also to Princess Royal to see the bears who live in the rainforest. But at all across Vancouver Island, also on rainforest conservation work. But I have to say, without a doubt, that Haida Gwaii is one of the most spectacular places on the planet. And I've been, as I said, about 6 or 7 times since 2020. And every time it just amazes me. I've been to the National Park Guayanas 3 times, once under my own steam kayaking for a week and then twice on vessels. And I've snorkeled. And I can tell you underwater, it is magical underwater in Haida Gwaii. It's one of the most marine... with sort of biodiverse parts of Canada in the underwater realm, and as the Haida say, the ocean provides, and it is spectacular underwater. So when people go to Haida Gwaii and they marvel at the big trees, they marvel at the UNESCO heritage site in the national park, and all the vibrant Haida communities that the tradition of carving is so alive and so impressive. All of that's true, but if you get to go snorkeling or scuba diving in Haida Gwaii, I think most people would be just blown away by what lives underwater. And there's a marine park at offshore of the national park, and that is co-managed by the Haida along with the National Park Reserve. It's spectacular. You can be sea kayaking and put a line in off for your kayak and suddenly catch a lingcod. And it just, you know, rockfish abound, kelp beds. And then there still are sea lions. And there's now, it's really exciting to hear that the otters have come back, the sea otters, which is really exciting. They have been moving in and moving north from Vancouver Island. And there are now sea otters in Haida Gwaii who will keep the urchin population down and hopefully protect the kelp beds. Yeah. So I have to say it's just a very spiritual place. It's stunning. Biggest black bears in North America. They're really large because they have a marine diet. They eat a lot of seafood, obviously salmon and shellfish along the beach. Big black and glossy bears. So it's my favorite place, and I need to get back there because it's whether you're looking for amethyst on Amethyst Beach on the northern shore, or you're in the national park down south admiring the biodiversity, or you're in Queen Charlotte City or Skidigate or Masset, it's spectacular. And so I encourage Canadians to go visit it. And, you can go by ferry from Prince Rupert. You can fly up from Vancouver in a 2-hour flight. It's not that far. Yeah. So it's my favorite place.
It's been on my list. I've yet to make it, but I'm definitely sold.
You'll be forever changed, David, when you go. You need a good week to 10 days and traveling by boat, by kayak, by canoe I definitely recommend that, not just by car. Not many roads in Haida Gwaii either. Right. So you really need to get on the water. There's a lot of Haida villages that are abandoned. The history is, of course, smallpox hit the communities and they were fairly vibrant about the 1870s. And then smallpox hit and the population was decimated from roughly 10,000 to 1,000 people. Wow. And what we see today is a community that is very successful, indigenous community, managing, co-managing forestry, co-managing fisheries offshore, very, very have a lot of agency. So it's a really great success story, coming from where the the smallpox pandemic was horrible and where they are today. So I think it's a great place to visit.
Sounds very, very hopeful.
And the geology is great too. We talk about pillow lavas in Haida Gwaii. The lavas are the size of king-size mattresses, king-size bed mattresses. If you're a geologist, you go crazy in Haida Gwaii as well. Truly. Yeah.
Awesome. That's great. Yeah. Well, listen, thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time, and this has been fascinating just spending some time
thank
in
you.
Some Arctic waters and different waters around the world with you today. And thank you again for plunging into Great Slave Lake in early March for us too, which is an incredible
thing. We'll be back next year. I can promise that with a slightly bigger team and a little bit more time to plan. But I think that it was so much fun. We'll do it again. And it was great fun. And it's still about minus 22 here. It hasn't warmed up. And the ice will be on the lake till end of May, beginning of June. So summer's coming, but it takes a long time to get here. It's short. And it's lovely, but and hopefully we won't have forest fires surrounding the city this year either. So we're just waiting to see what happens. But yeah, I'm looking forward to summer.
In the meantime, enjoy the longer days, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of you for listening. A reminder that Canadian Geographic is Canada's number one magazine. A subscription to it is only $28.50 a year. That gets you 6 print issues delivered and full digital access. $28.50 for the year. Think about that. That's basically what Netflix now charges for a month. And CanGeo is way more mentally nourishing. To sign up, go to canadiangeographic.ca/subscribe. We'll be happy that you did. And if you enjoy what we do here on Explore, please recommend it to a friend. It helps more people to find these conversations. And also, please rate and review us wherever you're listening to this. We love to get your feedback. Until next time, when we'll explore again, I'm David McGuffin.
I think right now we're enjoying very much looking back at the Earth, and it's just a fantastic experience, and I just can't wait to get back and start telling people.
We left Simpson about June 10th with a fur brigade consisting of a number of York boats, each manned by 10 voyageurs.
For us Inuit, it means that Inuit oral history is very strong.
And we flew low over every inch of the country that could be. We were hoping that he would fire at us.
Oh, I guess 160 dives or so. There are shrimp swimming around outside. It's just fabulous here.
Well, I'm a first for Canada.